Today at Reader's Corner, H.W. Brands, author of The General versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. More than six decades ago, President Harry Truman made a decision to fire an incredibly popular general with near celebrity status, General Douglas MacArthur. Was it a good decision? Only the future would tell. It was a difficult decision at a critical time. The Cold War had reached a crisis point. People around the world lived in fear of the atomic bomb, and the Chinese had joined the Korean War against the United States and its allies. The president wanted to contain the war, and the general wanted to expand it. The world needed to get serious about arms control, or was it too late? Or who had the authority to make decisions on the brink of a nuclear World War III? H.W. Brands explores this fascinating period in American history in The General versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Brands. He is the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin, the author of 25 books, and a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's been a guest on our show several times in the past, and we're pleased he could join us by phone to talk about his latest book. Bill Brands, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Oh, a great pleasure to be talking with you again, Bob.
Well, Bill, let's start right in the middle, or maybe it's even the end. I was really fascinated by the former Secretary of the Army under Truman, and you recount what Frank Pace had to say after he left office, after Truman's gone years later. Frank Pace is asking the question, did MacArthur engineer his own firing? In a sense, he's answering the question because he comes up with the theory that, in fact, no general as astute as MacArthur could have for a moment thought he could get by with saying all the things he said without getting fired and then going back to the United States where he could run against Truman as the Republican nominee. What do you think of that?
It's really tempting to draw that conclusion because exactly as you say, MacArthur was a smart guy. And he realized that he was pushing Truman. And at some point, presumably, Truman would have to relieve him. It's tempting to say that, but I can't say it with great confidence because it's really hard to get inside the head of Douglas MacArthur. He was a smart guy, but he had some serious blind spots. And one of the blind spots was an understanding of the way American politics worked. MacArthur had been absent from the United States for 15 years. He had gone off to the Philippines in the 1930s to prepare the Philippines, then an American colony, for independence. And he had stayed in the Philippines until the outbreak of World War II against Japan. He had evacuated to Australia. The only time he set foot on American soil was briefly for half a day in Honolulu when he met with President Franklin Roosevelt in World War II. But for the rest of it, he had really fallen out of touch with what American politics was all about. He also had a habit of surrounding himself with people who simply told him what he wanted to hear. And as a result of this, when you sort of look at this story as I do, trying to get it both from Truman's perspective and from MacArthur's perspective, from Truman's perspective, you say, he's got to be seeing what this is leading up to. He can't keep doing it. But on the other hand, from his perspective, there's a possibility, and he's thinking that he can continue to intimidate Truman as he has all along. Because one of the striking parts of the story is that not even the Joint Chiefs of Staff were willing to explicitly rein him in. It's remarkable that this is a U.S. commander who is serving under them, and when he starts doing stuff that is kind of edging up against, going against the president's policy, they still refuse to give him an explicit order saying, you can't do this. And the reason they refused is, and Matthew Ridgway, who eventually succeeded MacArthur, put this question to Omar Bradley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He says, why don't you just give MacArthur an order? And Bradley turned to him and he said, well, what are we going to do if he disobeys the order? Because this was an odd situation where, under the Constitution, the president clearly outranks any military officer. The president is commander-in-chief. But politically speaking, emotionally speaking, MacArthur far outranked Truman. MacArthur was a five-star general. He was a hero of the war in the Pacific. Truman had been a captain of artillery during the First World War. He was an accidental president. What did he know? So MacArthur could very well have thought that he could continue to get away with pushing the boundary the way he had up until that crucial point.
By the way, why don't we give our listeners a time frame here? Truman comes into the presidency in 1945. Then give us when the Korean War breaks out and when it's ended.
Okay, so Truman becomes president in 1945 upon the sudden death of Franklin Roosevelt. Truman was nobody's idea of somebody who should be president. He was generally seen as this hack politician from Missouri who was made vice president in 1944 because there was a revolt in the Democratic Party against the incumbent, Henry Wallace. And then Truman becomes president. It was widely assumed that he would serve no more than the rest of that term and would either step aside or would be voted out. Surprisingly, he won re-election in 1948, but that did not improve a lot of Americans' view of Harry Truman. It's important in all of this to keep in mind that Truman was an extremely controversial president, and when he left office in 1953, he was the most unpopular president in American history, even including Richard Nixon at the depths of Watergate. So in 1950, war breaks out in Korea. This is in June of 1950, and for the first 3 months, the war was very badly for the United States. Truman, believing that the United States could not afford to lose another Asian country to communism, China had just gone communist several months before. This is the most populous country in the world. This was a real blow to America's Cold War policy of trying to contain communism. And after China goes communist, Truman believes that the U.S. can't afford to see Korea go communist. Communist North Korea invades anti-communist South Korea, and Truman decides to step in. He throws American forces into the breach, but for the first 3 months, things do not go very well. And Douglas MacArthur, who's the American commander, has all he can simply to prevent American and South Korean forces from being driven off the Korean Peninsula. So that's when all of this begins to take place. And during this time, it becomes clear that MacArthur has different ideas on how the war in Korea ought to be fought than Truman does.
So every time we get into one of the United States gets into one of these conflicts, there's always this issue of whether or not Congress should be declaring war. Help us understand in this case how Truman decided to define war and the role that the United Nations would play in his justification.
In every war that the United States had fought since the Constitution was adopted in 1789, presidents had gone to Congress and requested a war declaration, and Congress came through. But in 1950, the United States was, for the first time in its history, living under the shadow of nuclear war. The United States had developed nuclear weapons at the end of World War II. The Soviet Union didn't get them until 1949. And the Korean War breaks out several months after that. The feeling was, on the part of Truman and his advisors, that in the nuclear age, there's not time to have a debate. In previous times, Congress had debated sometimes for hours, sometimes for days, over whether there should be a war. And Truman believed we don't have that kind of time. Furthermore, the United Nations had requested, had authorized the United States and other member states of the United Nations to go to the assistance of South Korea. So Truman could present this as not a war exactly. The term that he used was a police action at the behest of the United Nations. And police action was what it became. When Truman made this decision to send American forces to South Korea without asking Congress for a war declaration, he had no desire to, and he had no idea that he was setting a precedent. In fact, from that day until now, Congress has never declared a war, despite the fact that the United States fought wars in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf and Afghanistan and Iraq.
Now, there was a stroke of luck involved here regarding the UN that facilitated the decision for Truman. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So after the communist victory in China, the United States refused to acknowledge, that is to diplomatically recognize, the new communist government of China. It maintained that the pre-existing government of China, which had fled the mainland of China to Taiwan, or Formosa, as it was called in those days, it was called the nationalist government. That was the real government. And the Soviet Union boycotted meetings of the Security Council. The Security Council is the central, really, decision-making body at the UN. And the five charter members, including the Soviet Union, can exercise a veto over any substantive action. Well, in protest of the American refusal to seat the communist delegate, the Soviet delegate, he wasn't there. And because all of this unfolded so quickly, he didn't have time to come back before the Security Council sat down and authorized American and other countries' support of South Korea. If he had been there, he certainly would have vetoed it, but he wasn't there. The decision was made. He quickly came back, so the Security Council couldn't do anything more, but because it also couldn't undo what it had done, because now the United States could veto the undoing. And so this was a war where the United States found itself operating under the aegis of the United Nations. This served Harry Truman's purposes very well, because Truman was a strong supporter of the United Nations, and the idea of the United Nations was that it would take the burden of keeping world peace off the United States exclusively. It would spread the responsibility around, and it would deter troublemakers in the future from starting wars, because those troublemakers would know that the weight of the entire United Nations was against them.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is H.W. Brands, author of The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. You know, I can still remember as a little boy, a guy up the street went off to fight the Korean War and never came back. And when I was reading your book, and I know this isn't necessarily a book on the strategy of the Korean War, but you did mention at one point that in the early months of that conflict, both UN and American troops were throwing bazookas at substantial tanks and simply getting overrun. Do you have any idea how that all happened? Were we simply unprepared in those initial months? Had we not gotten the military hardware over there that they needed? What was going on?
The United States was unprepared. One of the things that's often forgotten in sort of broad-gauge histories of the United States since 1945, The notion is that the United States emerged from World War II as the greatest military power in the world and remained that ever since. Well, in broad terms, that's true. But what happened in 1945 was Americans did what they had done after every war in American history until then. They demobilized. And the 16 million men and women under arms, they melted away, and the army was down to about a million. And the armaments were auctioned off and made surplus and all this other stuff. So by 1950, the United States military was a shadow of what it had been at the time of the victory over Japan and Germany. The result of this was that when American troops were sent in to fight in Korea, they did not have the equipment to stand up to the military hardware that was supplied to North Korea by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union never demobilized, but the United States had. It partly because this was the American tradition, partly because there was a belief that in the nuclear age, you don't have to have so many conventional weapons. But what Korea made clear was, even in the nuclear age, you have to fight very hard with conventional weapons. In fact, maybe you have to fight even harder because you don't want to have to use nuclear weapons. The result was that America was quite unprepared to fight in Korea at the time the war broke out. And that's why it was so difficult for Americans to hold on against the Army of North Korea, which was probably, you know, 10th, 20th most powerful military in the world. I mean, it was a really small, ragtag kind of army that was pushing the United States around.
As I read your book, and I'm getting all of these quotations from MacArthur, all of the various things he had to say during the war, Truman sitting in the White House trying to run this war, but on a fairly regular basis, he and his staff are frustrated by the fact that MacArthur wants to go off in a different direction. He's disagreeing. He's contradicting. I mean, there must be a half dozen good examples of things MacArthur did which really ought to get the ire of the president up. And then finally, it appears as though there was a VFW speech that may have been the final blow. Tell us about that.
The basic issue was that MacArthur believed that there was going to be a showdown with the communists, and that once the Korean War began, the showdown had begun. And so he believed that it suited the United States to go all out, or as much out as was necessary, to defeat communism decisively in Asia. If this meant expanding the war and taking on China, he was willing to do that. Harry Truman was not, in part because Truman, well, as the one person in world history ever to have used nuclear weapons, he didn't want to have to be put in a position where he needs to use them again. But furthermore, Truman believed that ground zero of the Cold War was not East Asia, was not Korea, was not China, but was Central Europe. That the Cold War would be won or lost depending on what happened in and to Germany. And what Truman understood, in a way that MacArthur didn't sufficiently appreciate, was that the United States was in no position in 1950 to do what it had done in 1945, and that was to wage a two-front war, to wage a war in Asia and a war in Europe. The American military was a shadow of what it had been. And so every time MacArthur did something that threatened to get the United States more deeply involved in Asia, in the thinking of Truman and his military and civilian advisors, that raised the risk that the United States would not be able to respond to a Soviet counter move against Germany. And MacArthur had this long history of focusing on his own theater of whatever war he was in World War II. He continually made the argument that the war was going to be won or lost in the Pacific. Forget about Europe. Europe's not important. It's the Pacific that's important. It was always about wherever MacArthur happened to be at the time. He made the same argument in the Korean War. And Truman and his military advisors in Washington were buying it, because they believed that the epicenter of the Cold War was in Germany. And the United States needed to prepare to deal with that. If the worst happened in Korea and the United States was driven out of Korea, that would not defeat the free world in the Cold War. But if the United States was driven out of Germany and Western Europe, that would defeat the free world in the Cold War. And Truman could never get MacArthur to accept that.
So what's the final straw? I mentioned that VFW speech. When was that given?
That was given in the summer of 1950, and that put Truman on edge, and he just about pulled the plug. In fact, he later said that when he read that speech saying that the Truman policy is not sufficient to win the Cold War against communism, and it was clearly a case of an American military commander contradicting the policy of the President of the United States. Now, Truman was not particularly thin-skinned. He didn't mind people criticizing. People in Congress said lots worse about him than that. Truman's problem with this was that he figured that foreign countries would not know what American policy was. Who do you listen to? Do you listen to the President of the United States, or do you listen to this five-star general? And so it was this confusion that caused Truman to think, and later to say, that after that particular speech, MacArthur had to be fired. But he didn't fire him just then, because shortly thereafter, the war turned in America's favor. And it looked as though the war was going to end in just a few weeks, and so all would be well. But that didn't happen. China entered the war, and the war entered into a new phase. So what finally tipped the balance was when a Republican leader in Congress gave a bitterly anti-Truman speech, and he sent a copy of the speech to MacArthur. And MacArthur wrote a letter back, which he knew was going to be published, saying, "I agree with you. You've said very important things." And this was just a slap against the president. And given the partisan nature of the speech and presumably then MacArthur's response, this was what caused Frank Pace and some other people to think MacArthur had to know this was going to lead to his firing. And that MacArthur at this point had convinced himself that he would make a far better president than Harry Truman. And so he sets himself up to get fired, come home, in a reign of ticker tape, which is what happened after he got fired, and run for president, which is exactly what he did.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with H.W. Brands about his book, The General Versus the President, which is about the power struggle between President Harry Truman and General Douglas MacArthur. But he winds up at the Republican convention giving a speech that didn't exactly get the job done. Tell us about that.
No, in fact, so MacArthur, when he came back, shortly after he was fired, he was invited to Congress to give a speech before a joint session of the House and the Senate. And he gave this speech that it was one of the most moving, powerful speeches anybody had ever heard. He was a good speaker when he was in the right place. And he had the members of Congress, they were weeping when they were supposed to weep. They were cheering when they were supposed to cheer. And everybody thought he just knocked it out of the park. And if the Republican convention could have been held on that day, then MacArthur would have been made the Republican nominee for 1952 by acclamation. But in fact, what happened was, and what MacArthur didn't realize was, the cheering for MacArthur was not for MacArthur as a presidential candidate. It was for MacArthur as a hero of World War II. And this was his first time home. This was his first time to get a chance to receive that kind of applause and celebration that other generals from World War II had enjoyed before. But MacArthur mistook this as saying, okay, you know, we think he ought to be the next president. In fact, what became apparent fairly quickly was that MacArthur lacked the common touch that was really necessary in politics in those days. And there was another general, somebody as celebrated as MacArthur, who did have the common touch, Dwight Eisenhower. And when Eisenhower saw what the response to MacArthur was, and realized, you know, I'd be a better president than MacArthur would, then Eisenhower throws his general's hat in the ring. And Eisenhower wins over Republicans who wanted anybody but Truman and who wanted a general, but were put off a little bit by this guy MacArthur, who could be arrogant, who could be haughty, who was pretty old. He was 70. He was as old as Donald Trump is. And so it was Eisenhower who was the general nominee of the party and not Douglas MacArthur. But MacArthur is allowed to go to the Republican convention because in those days there was still the possibility that the convention could make its decision independent of the primary votes. The delegates weren't all locked up the way they were today. And when he stood up to give his speech, there was this huge standing ovation when he walked into the hall. And some of the commentators said, oh my gosh, this looks like the speech that he gave to Congress. And maybe he could stampede the convention. But it was the first time MacArthur appeared in civilian dress. In his campaign up until then, he had been in his five-star general uniform. But when he started speaking, people realized that, you know, this just isn't the same thing. And that the business of a nominating convention is not to applaud heroes from a war in the past, but to choose somebody who can win in the election coming up. And they compared MacArthur to Eisenhower. And they decided they're going to put their money on Eisenhower. And so he gives this speech, turns out to be his last important public speech, and it just went over very poorly. By the end of the speech, it was pretty embarrassing. This was in the early days of television and politics. And by the end of the speech, the delegates were getting distracted. They were talking among themselves, and this is something that nobody would have done to MacArthur before. But by the end of the speech, it's really clear that in political terms, this guy's day has passed.
When it comes to the final decision to remove MacArthur from his command, as I remember it, you talk about the Joint Chiefs of Staff's role. Now, earlier you said that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were afraid in the theater of war to go against MacArthur, but when it came time for Harry Truman to make the decision, it sounds as though these generals in the Pentagon were clearly on the side of Truman in recognizing the fact that there must be civilian control of the military.
Oh, they definitely were. Now, it's important to know that as celebrated as MacArthur was, he was not loved within the Army. Uh-huh. In fact, when I've been giving lectures about the book, I have encountered people who either were vets of the Korean War or whose father or uncle was a vet in the Korean War, and some of them had served under MacArthur in World War II. And almost everyone who had personal knowledge of MacArthur as a subordinate of MacArthur detested him, because they figured he was arrogant, he was a showboat, he claimed all the credit for himself rather than giving credit to the soldiers who actually did the fighting. So he was not at all beloved among the uniformed military class. Truman's military advisors, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, were more than happy to say MacArthur needs to be relieved. Now, they were quite happy for Truman to be the one who signs the order, who issues the order to have him relieved. They didn't want to do it themselves, and they were perfectly aware that that's what their role was. The Joint Chiefs, they give advice to the president. The president is the one who makes the decision, and Truman made the decision. And it's interesting, when he made the decision, the members of his press office were trying to figure out what they should say in the press release. And the top line was that the president decided that General MacArthur will be relieved of his command. And one of the young people on Truman's staff said, and so shouldn't we include, that this is on the unanimous advice of your military and civilian advisors. And Truman took him aside and said, son, not tonight. Tonight, it's on me alone. I am making a decision on my own authority. Tomorrow, we'll explain what the advice was, but I don't want anybody thinking that I'm putting this off on the Joint Chiefs or on Secretary of Defense Marshall or on Secretary of State Dean Acheson. This is my decision.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's just amazing to read your book and see these references to Truman's concern about nuclear war and how he's fighting back MacArthur's efforts to expand and use the war and bring the communist Chinese in. I can see why you historians like your job, because in a sense, history proves the present wrong. And by that, I mean that Truman, as you already indicated, left with this really horrible approval rating. And I gather today we would have nothing but enormous impressions of his character, his strength, the way he probably did keep us out of war. I mean, the larger war, the number three.
Well, this is what allows us historians to say whenever we're asked, so what do you think about the Obama presidency? What do you think about this? We always say it's too soon to tell.
Sure.
And in Truman's case, it really was, because when Truman left office, he was horribly unpopular, and he remained one of the most unpopular presidents in American history for about 20 or 30 years. And what really revived his reputation was that eventually the United States won the Cold War on Harry Truman's terms. And sometimes it takes that long for the wisdom of policies to become evident. Now, Truman is ranked in the, say, top five of all presidents.
Are you asked any questions out on the trail as you're explaining your book about how this book has any lessons in it about what's happened since the November election? I know not many weeks have gone by, but just curious.
Well, I am asked about it. I usually try to dodge the question in terms that I just said that, you know, we really don't know. But it is interesting that there was a moment in the campaign where Donald Trump announced that Douglas MacArthur was one of his favorite generals, and we should have more generals like that. One of the reasons that MacArthur remains popular among Americans and with Donald Trump is that he's a representative of a moment when the United States could use all of its great military power against enemies. And this was World War II. World War II is the model war in the thinking of many Americans of a certain age, because we were on the side of right, and we used everything we had to smash the bad guys. And it's been very frustrating for many Americans since then, because the United States has been to war several times, but never used all of its might for fear that it would blow up into a nuclear war. So respect for Trump, admiration for MacArthur is sort of a nostalgia for this time when the United States could follow MacArthur's advice when he said, in war, there's no substitute for victory. Harry Truman understood that, no, actually, survival might be more important than victory in the nuclear age. I had to smile when, after saying that we should have more generals like MacArthur, then Trump went on to say, and I wouldn't have my generals giving press conferences all the time. Well, that's what MacArthur did all the time. He gave press conferences. And so there's part of the memory of MacArthur that resonates, another part that doesn't do quite so much.
Your book relies on many accounts from press briefings. What was Truman's relationship like with the press compared to our modern-day presidents?
Truman came along at a time when the rules of presidential press conferences were different than they are today. Press conferences weren't such a high-stakes undertaking as they are today. Harry Truman also had a very good relationship with the press corps, because he made a point of straight talking. He liked to call himself Straight Talking Harry. And he would give them quite honest answers. He wasn't somebody who tried to retreat behind a wall of subterfuge or mumbly gook. And he would tell them what he thought. And for that reason, they really liked it. And there wasn't such an adversarial relationship between the press and the presidency as has developed these days. Mm-hmm. The turning point that time was the 1960s, especially Watergate, when presidents were clearly lying to the media. And so good relations between the president and newspaper reporters were not uncommon. Franklin Roosevelt had really good relations with the media as well.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, I want to remind our listeners, the name of the book, The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. We've barely scratched the surface. I can assure listeners, this is a great read. H.W. Brands, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure, Bob. Good to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore interview with H.W. Brands. Next week, Elizabeth Letts, author of The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.